Welcome to We've Got Issues. I'm Joshua Holland. This week we're going to be joined by Kevin Cruz, a professor of history at Princeton University. I'm sure you've heard of it. First, as always, I'm joined by Elizabeth Preza, Alternet's managing editor. Hello, Liz.
Hi. I'm thinking about taking up smoking again.
You know, I mean, the end of the world might be nigh. It would be bad to quit smoking, you know, suffer privation when we could end, 2020 with a giant earth-shattering asteroid.
Yeah, pianos falling from the sky.
I mean, it would be consistent at least. How are you holding up?
I'm hanging in there, I guess. I don't know.
It's exhausting, isn't it?
It's exhausting. I'm so tired. It's been 5 years of this shit. As in Donald Trump.
Yeah. No, it's been, yeah.
Every second has been worse than the one before it.
And the 2020 campaign started about 15 minutes after the results from the midterms came in. So it's been 2 years plus. And I share this sense of exhaustion. I'm tired of being stressed out by this just crackpot coup d'etat attempt. And also, I worry because I'm not worried that it'll be successful. There's no path. But I worry about the consequences of it in terms of, we've talked about this before, you know, unhinged cultists with lots of guns, who knows? And I'm worried about how the next years are going to play out because they are preemptively delegitimizing Biden's presidency. Mm-hmm. This is going to give leave to Republicans to, you know, be as obstreperous as possible. And it's just, it's a mess. And I'm tired of stressing out over this ridiculous bullshit. I mean, Jesus Christ. And it seems like there's no limit to their antics. You know, it's almost comical. Today is Thursday. We had that another bizarre press conference right after the Four Seasons thing. Now there was another one where Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell and Jenna Ellis, the last lawyers who are working on Trump's silly, you know, Keystone coup, held a press conference. Rudy, who is, I wrote about this week. Rudy is the best comic relief since Joe Pesci's character in Lethal Weapon. So he's given this press conference and all of a sudden hair dye is melting down the sides of his head. He's got like diarrhea flowing from his hair down to his chin. He's so full of shit. Yeah, it's sweating out of his pores. And I'm exhausted by it.
Yeah. And one of the things that's frustrating too is that one of the consequences is that it's never going to end. it's never going to end. It's really not, you know, even when Biden assumes the presidency, it's never going to end.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing that I'm always looking for silver linings. I am a pessimistic person, but I have this little optimistic streak. And the only thing that I can say is that, you know, I am not hopeful. That's exaggerating it. It seems like it's a remote possibility that because Trump will be, you know, running for president in 2024 and being an asshole on Twitter,
right,
maybe we can avoid the usual Democratic midterm drop off. That's the only kind of potential silver lining, just because he does fire up. Right. I mean, he does fire up the Democratic base.
Right.
He fires up both bases, but he really fires up the Democratic base, and he won't be on the ballot himself. So I don't know, but it is exhausting, and you're right. It's, you know, they're creating a lost cause narrative like after the Civil War. So, you know, it's and these people are just such weird, nasty, conspiratorial people. And it's weird in that, you know, there's like no bottom. The things that they say, I mean, this press conference, they were talking about how Hugo Chavez, who died, by the way, is like counting the I couldn't even track it. It was like Hugo Chavez is involved in this communist plot with this company in Spain, and the Cubans are involved, and George Soros is involved, and these people are lawyers. I mean, it's like, what are you even talking about? And they're also nasty pieces of work, really nasty. Yeah. Check out this little clip. This is one of Trump's lawyers. This is Jenna Ellis. And let's just take a listen to this woman railing on the media.
And we go through a jury process. This is the court of public opinion right now. We are not trying our case in the court of public opinion, because if we were, we would get unbiased jurors. I would strike 99% of you from the jury, and I would be allowed to because of the fake news coverage you provide. You are not unbiased jurors. And until you step out of your role as a journalist and actually go into a courtroom and you are a judge on a bench that has sworn an oath to be unbiased in our separation of powers, then your opinion does not matter. The facts matter, the truth matters, and if you are fair reporters, you will cover that fairly and appropriately, and you will allow coverage of our media team here and our legal team. That is absolutely shocking that all you cover are around the margins, and I've seen all of you taking pictures right now, and I can anticipate what your headlines are going to be. If you are not willing to talk about the evidence that has been presented, then that is absolutely unacceptable for journalistic standards.
So, I mean, she's a nasty piece of work. Mm-hmm. Just nasty. And,
I think she's the same one who, like, you know, a couple years ago also called Trump an idiot and called his Trump followers an idiot and blah, 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 blah. And I just have, like, what happened to these people? Her, Lindsey Graham, so many, really, of these Republicans who went from, you know, speaking out about what a crazy person Donald Trump is to becoming crazy people themselves.
Yeah, it's a weird phenomenon. It really is. With Lindsey Graham, though, I think that he is, and this isn't an original observation. Someone mentioned this the other day. They likened him to a remora, which are the fish that cling to sharks and other mm-hmm. large predators and clean them off. They have a symbiotic relationship. Yeah. And a parasitic being, and he latches on to a powerful figure. It was John McCain for many years. Mm-hmm. So Lindsey was a mavericky Republican who would sometimes be reasonable like John McCain. He was also, you know, a warmonger like John. He basically adopted John McCain's personality. John McCain dies, and he's now latched on to Trump and just become a complete Trumpist. It's
interesting.
Yeah, it is very weird.
Yeah. I wonder, is he like a nice person when you meet him in person? And that's like why all these people like him. Yeah. No. I know. No. I figure that's not the case, but it's just so bizarre to see people go from.
None of these people are nice people. Honestly, I mean, no, none I of them that. Are nice. I mean, even like I lived in DC for a year in 2005 and you know, I had friends who were in the service industry, and they'd be like, you know, these guys are just absolute pricks and cheap tippers and just really obnoxious people.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So not fun to wait on. Not fun to wait on. Oh. And now they're involved in a coup d'etat. And I guess this is the one thing that I'll say is that I wrote about this week, how it's we're in this weird, what Chris Hayes would say, a liminal space. He likes talking about a liminal space. There's this weird liminal space between comedy and horror. Mm. And the thing is, we are rightly dismissive of this nonsensical coup. But, you know, it's an attempted coup d'etat in the United States, right? I mean, it's like, just because the perpetrators are clowns. Mm-hmm. This is my puppy, Emma. She's also angry about it. Just because the perpetrators are clowns, there's no such thing as an unserious attempted coup d'etat in a 240-year-old democracy.
Right.
And it's hard to kind of find that balance because, you know, it's not going to work. And, you know, it's funny. It is comical at times, but
but almost like giving it oxygen is problematic in that. But also, how can you not give it oxygen? Because it's there. It's being it's played out right in front of us. It was established before that this was going to happen. So there's an element of, okay, we've been warning you about this. We've been for saying it's going to happen. We've been dismissed as hysterical, and now it's happening. And we don't have any recourse. We just have to sit back and watch it play out.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing that's the thing that is comforting is that even a very right-wing judge needs something to hang their hook on, to hang their hat on. They need something there. And these cases are so specious. And the lawyers, you know, they have professional obligations to not misrepresent. They have ethical requirements that they not lie to the court.
Right.
And so these Trump lawyers go into court and they say, we are not alleging fraud.
Right.
And then they go in front of the press and they say, oh, this is this widespread fraud. It's the worst crime in the history of the world. But when they go into court,
they have to be
honest. They know better. And that's why I believe they are, as of this recording, 1 and 27 in court cases.
Wow.
And the one affected a tiny number of ballots. It was in Pennsylvania, and they said that some ballots that came in an extended 3-day period, very late ballots, would not be counted. And those are a tiny handful of ballots. It doesn't matter. And that's the only win that they've had. And they, they have nothing.
I think we talked about this last time, but it's amazing to think about what would have happened if it were any closer, if Biden didn't have a decisive victory in so many states.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, this is what we said. We've been saying it for months. You know, we need to have a decisive win, and Trump is going to, demonize mail-in voting, sabotage the post office, count on this red mirage and the blue shift the next day. That would be the premise to claim widespread fraud. And it's all happening exactly the way we've been saying for several months. And as you said, some people said that we were hysterical, but here it is. It's all playing out.
Yep. Yeah, it's amazing.
Anyway, let's take a quick break and then come back with Kevin Cruz. He's a great Twitter personality and a good historian. Stay tuned. We'll take a quick break and come right back. They keep on telling you how to live your life, and all the rights and the wrongs you're gonna do. They're thinking that they're the boss, your friends, your wife. You keep on playing the song, but they won't boo. Welcome back. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by Kevin Cruz. He's a historian at Princeton University. He specializes in 20th century American history with a focus on the civil rights movement. He is the author most recently of Fault Lines, A History of America Since 1974 with Julian Seltzer, who was on the show a few weeks ago. And you may know him as the slayer of former felon and right-wing provocateur Dinesh D'Souza. Welcome to the show, Kevin.
Glad to be here.
I'm really happy to have you. We are recording this on Thursday. The big news is that President Trump personally called the two Republican canvassers in Wayne County, Michigan. They had certified the vote count in Wayne County. Now they're trying to rescind their support for certifying the vote. Wayne County includes Detroit and is home to half of the Black population of Michigan. The Trump campaign withdrew their lawsuit in Michigan, claiming that they had stopped Wayne County from certifying, even though they didn't. These two wing nuts, one of them who had shared a bunch of Facebook stuff accusing Obama of being a crypto Muslim and a terrorist, had sent a letter requesting that their certification be rescinded. But, you know, I don't think a judge is going to be like, oh, well, you got a call from the losing candidate, so this seems kosher. We're in this very weird space. It is a coup d'etat. It's like a crackpot coup d'etat. And I'm having a hard time processing this in terms of some of this stuff is so laughable. I mean, you could not script something better than Rudy Giuliani going to the Four Seasons Total Landscaping, or, you know, his shenanigans in a courtroom. But this is deadly serious. I mean, they are undermining not only the public's faith in our elections, but they are setting up the Joe Biden to be an illegitimate president in the eyes of half the country. They're setting up kind of a new, more conspiratorial Tea Party movement for his presidency. And in a way, I liken this almost to birtherism for a white guy named Joe from Scranton. We're in totally uncharted waters, right? I mean, is there any historical parallel to this period?
There's really no historical parallel for this. I mean, we've got obviously the Bush v. Gore case in 2000, but that was a single state in which the margin was incredibly small, and the calls had gone back and forth. We don't have that in any single state here. In fact, it's spread out by multiple states. Trump would have to flip, you know, what, three or four to actually make this happen. And then, you know, in terms of somebody pressing a recount, you know, Nixon made some noise in 1960 that he was going to maybe challenge it, but that quickly faded away. So there really is nothing like this, certainly not from an incumbent president who really lost this badly to still be complaining about it and trying to kick up some kind of defiance 2 weeks later.
You know, the only thing that I thought about as far as the crackpottiness was the coup attempt against FDR. Because that was kind of a ham-fisted attempt, wasn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, and that's something that I think is really remarkable about this one is that it does kind of echo that in how clumsy it's been. But it's showing just how dangerous this would be if it were in the hands of more competent people.
Yeah. And this is an interesting question because I've said, like many others, that, you know, I worry about a more disciplined, less buffoonish version of Trump, say, you know, an authoritarian like Tom Cotton or something. But as I think about it, and I think about this huge education gap among whites and the fact that Trump inspired a massive turnout on both sides, but a massive turnout of irregular voters, white non-college voters particularly, who hadn't voted for other Republicans are not really, you know, solid partisans. I wonder if a more disciplined, less crackpotty, less showman-like version of Trump would have that same appeal.
Yeah, that's the question. Is if you had somebody more professional here who were trying to do the same things Trump would, they'd probably be able to pull him off better. But I don't think they would have the same broad public support. I mean, it's kind of like the relationship between George Wallace and Richard Nixon. They sounded some of the same themes. People love George Wallace. Nobody really loved Richard Nixon, but he was more effective, obviously, as a candidate and certainly as a president, because he seemed not as crackpotty.
Yeah, right. Nixon kind of threaded the needle. That's where we got the kind of coded dog whistle. He tried to kind of capitalize on the same currents that Wallace was stirring up, but while maintaining kind of a reputation as a more boring version and a rock of stability in these turbulent times. I think that's one of the reasons that Trump's law and order shtick failed. We talked about this on the show at the time, was because, you know, unlike Nixon, he is a chaos monkey and nobody's going to turn to Trump and be like, oh, this guy is going to bring stability and calmness in the middle of these turbulent times. So after hearing everything about, you know, white suburbanites shifting towards Democrats, et cetera, Biden ended up winning, according to the exit polls, which we have to take with a big grain of salt, 41% of the white vote. He did win college graduates by a narrow margin. But he lost non-college whites 2-1. And I'm struck by the fact that Biden won 41% of the white vote. Obama in 2008 won 43% of the white vote. So he underperformed Obama among white voters. And Dems haven't won the white vote since 1964. Now, before the election, you wrote about how the RNC, the Republican National Committee, had been under a consent decree barring them from harassing voters in the guise of poll monitoring, right? They say, oh, we're sending people to monitor the polls, and they would intimidate voters. That was lifted by a judge in 2018. We ended up with a bunch of, voter intimidation by Republican poll watchers this cycle. And after the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act in Shelby County versus Holder, all these states with a history of suppressing minority votes that had previously been required to pre-clear changes in election administration were set free, and we got a torrent of voter suppression in those states. So here's my question. We tend to see things as discrete eras. You know, this is not the civil rights era. This is the 21st century. But is it all a continuum, if you think about it? Like, the Civil War gave rise to the Lost Cause mythology, which to a large degree gave birth to Jim Crow. The civil rights era, as we call it, led to a realignment of working class whites. And here we are. It's 2020. We're facing this huge white education gap. And the far right is once again dreaming of a civil war. Does this story ever end? Like, where is Francis Fukuyama in the end of history when you need him?
Well, it's clearly one long struggle. And I think what we've really realized in the last few years is that the argument that the majority in Shelby County v. Holder laid out that hey, the Voting Rights Act isn't needed anymore, look at all the problems we've solved, was clearly wrong. Because as soon as those protections went away, as soon as the requirement for pre-clearance was taken away, we saw all these states immediately. There are a couple ones that filed within hours to have new measures to restrict and suppress the vote. And so you look at a state like Georgia, where we're all looking at right now, between the late 1960s and 2012, the Department of Justice blocked 177 different proposed changes that they were going to make to their election laws, from redistricting to restricting election access, to help for people who were illiterate, who needed help at the polls. They blocked all those. And then as soon as Shelby County came down, Georgia went right at it. And Brian Kemp, who's now the governor, was Secretary of State, purged 1.4 million voters from the rolls. They implemented voter ID. They implemented all kinds of new laws. They closed down lots of polling places. They did everything that the Department of Justice had been guarding against for about five decades, and they put it into place. And lo and behold, Brian Kemp ran for governor with that very trimmed electorate, very restricted election. And he won in 2018 by 55,000 votes?
Yeah.
So it shows that those things were needed and that they made a difference.
It's so frustrating. I mean, the rationale was that these things worked, so that's why we're going to get rid of them. I mean, that was basically the premise on which Shelby was ruled, was, you know, these things, we're not seeing these kinds of efforts to suppress the vote in these states. And as you mentioned, there was a report by the Brennan Center for Justice, and I think it was 13,000 polling places were closed since Shelby County in those states that had previously had to get pre-clearance. So it's maddening that we go through this time and time again. And then the structural disadvantages for Democrats. I mean, here we are. Joe Biden is probably going to win the popular vote by 7 million. The next Senate, whether or not it's, Democrats sweep those two seats in Georgia, the Republican caucus is either the Republicans are going to be in charge or they're going to have 49 or 50 seats. And they will have won, I think, I saw an analysis at Vox or something, it was like 30 million fewer votes than the Democrats, because obviously the 17 people living in Wyoming get the same amount of representation as 37 gazillion in California. So we have to, like, you know, Democrats and people who believe in democracy and civil rights, we have to win again and again and again, you know, just to get a new Voting Rights Act passed. You know, we've mobilized, we've seen Democrats mobilize in two elections in a row. Can they do it a third time? The Senate map looks good for them in 2022, but then of course they're going to be the party in power, and the out party usually does well in midterms. We'll see if that cycle continues. One thing is that Trump may announce for 2024, and he's certainly going to be on the sidelines lobbing bombs, and that may keep Democrats motivated. This is my little glimmer of hope.
Right.
I want to shift gears a little bit and talk a bit about the pandemic and kind of get your sense as a historian. You know, 80 years from now, they'll be interviewing old people on the History Channel about what it was like to be like a Zoomer during the great COVID crisis of 2020. Do you have kind of a heightened sense of living through a historic crisis, something that is one of the biggest events in this country's history?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and it's not, it's certainly, and if you talk to any historian, you'll get this. We love reading about exciting times. We don't like living through them. We like to have them at arm's length in the archives. I actually found myself, my current project, I'm looking at the Department of Justice in the state of Florida, and I'm reading about horrific events, voter suppression, things like that in the past. I caught myself disappearing to the archives to try to get away from current events, to go back to look at these bad things, get away from the current. Because it's not just COVID. It's COVID. It's all the stuff going on with police and Black Lives Matter. It's the economic crisis. It's certainly this shattering crisis of democracy we're currently living through right now. It's the courts. It's all going on at once, and it's unbelievable. You know, and we've had these moments before in the past, right? I think what is really amazing for historians like me is, they've all been in separate moments in the past, right? So we had the influenza epidemic of 1918. We had the economic crash of 1929. We've had all these. We've had the urban riots of 67 and 68. Just not all at once, you know. and the term I use, I'm a child of the 80s. Is it's disaster Voltron. You know, we've put all these things together to form kind of a super disaster, and that's what we're living through. And it's just exhausting to be here. But we certainly are in the midst of a year that's going to be one of those transformational years that we look back on, like 1919, like 1968, like 1989. These are big pivotal moments. The problem is we're still in it, so it's hard to see what this is going to look like in 20, 40, 60, 80 years. But it's certainly going to be momentous.
Yeah, it's really, they just put it all in a bucket and don't skimp on the pate. That's 2020 for you. You know, when I think a lot about this, to tell you the truth, about how future historians are going to write about this time. You know, there was the other big story today. I guess there's always 80 million big news stories every day during the Trump era. But the militiamen who were going to kidnap Gretchen Whitmer, that woman from Michigan.
That woman, yeah.
They had a plan B. According to ABC News, they reported that their other plan was to take over the Capitol building with 200 militiamen and then stage a week-long series of televised executions of public officials. And I keep thinking about how people in the future will look back on this as a response to, mitigation measures against a pandemic that I think at the end of the day, when all is said and done, will probably kill a 500,000 Americans.
I think they'll look back at them just as we look at them now as I'm going to use a technical term here. It's batshit crazy.
Batshit crazy, yeah.
Look, we had people who resisted mask orders in 1918 and 1919.
Yes.
They didn't, as far as I know, try to hold mass executions for public officials who were doing that. And so we've certainly crossed into a new realm of insanity here. And again, as this pandemic gets worse, and we are clearly heading into the worst of it, just as happened with 1918, the second wave was much worse than the first, and it happened in winter. And we're going to have some serious death toll come out of this. We're looking at it's a 250,000 now. We could easily double that in short order. And so to look back at the people who resisted this, the people who protested in Michigan because they wanted to get a haircut, that's not going to stand up well in the long term. And I think we're going to see, but this is really a strand of selfishness and self-centeredness that has grown in American politics and social life over the last, 40, 50 years, has really reached an unhealthy crisis point.
Yeah, and I was thinking that they would look back on it and almost be as bewildered as we are. I said this on Twitter the other day at like the Victorian occult era. You know, we look back on that and we say, well, this was kind of a mass delusion. And if you look right now on within the conservative politics, you have this non-trivial share of the population that believes that Democrats and Tom Hanks are part of a cabal of, pedo cannibals that are, molesting and eating children to extract their adrenochrome. And it's the ancient blood libel against Jews that they made, matzah out of the babies, blood of Christian babies. And it's updated for the 21st century and put into Facebook memes. It's wild.
Yeah. So some of these conspiracies are timeless ones. And we certainly see echoes of that there. I mean, the real irony of that, that particular conspiracy is that we've got examples of pedophiles out there. There's the Jeffrey Epstein case. Two of the 2016 Trump state chairman maybe were caught doing sex trafficking. If that's what you're upset about, there are people doing it, but they happen to be on your side. So stop worrying about the imaginary basement and a pizza parlor if it doesn't exist, and worry about the actual people who are committing it. And so it's not that these things. I mean, the adrenochrome and all that other nonsense is garbage. But there are these things out there. Focus on the people who are actually doing them rather than working out these bizarre conspiracies and leave poor Tom Hanks out of it.
Yeah, leave Tom Hanks. I mean, everybody loves Tom Hanks. Everybody loves Dolly Parton.
We do not deserve Dolly Parton.
I mean, I have been lobbying for a long time to replace all Confederate statues with statues of Dolly Parton. She's a unifier.
Yep.
A uniter, not a divider. So I think, and also, rename. I'm sure you have this at Princeton, right? You have some halls that are named after slave owners or something like that. Rename them all after Dolly Parton. Everybody loves Dolly Parton. I would urge people to join my campaign to just rename everything after Dolly Parton.
Sign me up.
I'm gonna leave you with a little story. So, and this is about paying attention to little things when you're living through a momentous historical event. So, when I was 18, I met a woman. I dropped out of college, much to my parents' chagrin. I moved to West Berlin, and 6 months later, the Berlin Wall fell down, and I saw Pink Floyd's concert on the wall. Sprayed champagne, all this stuff. But the image that I have, this really all-encompassing image from this period, is this can of white asparagus. And I'll tell you why. So when the first weekend that they opened up the wall, they opened up the border between East and West Germany, they gave all of the East Germans 50 Deutschmarks each in Besuchsgeld, so visiting money. And that was worth, I don't know what it was worth. $75. Let's say it was $75. And this was, late 80s. So that was worth something. And they came in that weekend and they bought everything. They bought everything in the city that was priced less than $75 or whatever. So my ex and I, we had no food. And on Sunday at the end of the weekend, there was this big grocery store on the corner, and I went down there to get some food, and the shelves were completely, completely empty, except for this one sad can of white asparagus. Yeah. And I was like, this is the most poignant memory of the wall falling was this just empty grocery shelves and the one can of white asparagus. So pay attention to little things.
Absolutely.
Because you're living through history, and you may remember something that that the historians don't write down, like the can of white asparagus.
Yeah, everyone out there, you know, keep a diary, keep a journal, do something, because the people who do my job in a half century are going to be spending all their time saying, no, seriously, this actually happened.
That's exactly right. Kevin Cruz, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I really do appreciate
it. My pleasure, man.
I'd also like to thank Liz Prezza and David Edwards, our producer and engineer. I'd like to thank the good folks at Alternet and Raw Story for supporting the show. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, I'd like to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Hopefully, we can get this election wrapped up relatively soon and have a relaxing holiday. I'm calling out riot squads. I'm calling.